disagreed with Bella, she had a way of leaning her head back on her neck and staring at the disagreeer through the bottom of her spectacles with her eyes half closed, quizzical and skeptical. People began to notice that, while Robert Moses did not wear glasses, he was beginning to adopt, in arguments, the same tilt of the head. In later decades, when Robert Moses was famous almost as much for his personality as for his achievements, observers would marvel at the depth and degree of his outspokenness, stubbornness, aggressiveness, and arrogance. They would wonder at the origin of the mold in which he had been formed in so hard a cast. But relatives and friends of the Moses family never wondered. Whatever it was that made Robert Moses the way he was, they knew, whatever the quality that had shaped an unusual, in some ways unique, personality, the quality was one they had watched being passed, like a family heirloom, from Robert Moses' grandmother to his mother to him. Robert Moses, these people would say, is Bella Moses' son. Chapter 2. Robert Moses at Yale. If his mother spoiled Robert Moses, his college did not. Bella may not have considered him a Jew, but his classmates did, and at Yale University in 1905, this made a difference. Not in theory, of course. When Robert Moses went back to New Haven, Yale men were proudly proclaiming the university a democracy of talent that had spiritually entered the 20th century by throwing off its traditional social shackles. To prove it, undergraduates made a point of calling every classmate by his first name. But in fact, Yale was still a tightly sealed society. Of the 351 members of the class of 1909 who entered Yale with Moses in September 1905, most had graduated from the right Episcopalian private preparatory schools, 33 from Andover, for example, 23 from Hotchkiss, and 17 from St. Paul's. Moreover, as one of Moses' classmates recalls, as soon as you got to Yale, you found out that its structure was a social pyramid. Its base, the select sophomore societies, its next step, the even more select junior fraternities, its apex, the three senior societies, Skull and Bones, Scroll and Key, and Wolf's Head. 60 years later, surviving members of the class of 1909 could still remember watching classmates burst into tears on tap day when they realized that they were not to be selected for a senior society. The competition that counted at Yale was the competition to get to the top of that pyramid, Moses' classmate says. If you weren't in at least a junior fraternity, you were a nobody. But the competition was not open. It was largely based on family background, social connections, and prep school associations. And to no one was it closed more tightly than to Jews, of whom there were 5 in Moses' class, listed as Hebrews in the Freshman Blue Book, and lumped with the class's 18 Roman Catholics under miscellaneous denominations. In the 73 years that the senior societies had been in existence, they had never tapped a single Jew. And whatever the feelings of Bella's boy about whether he was or was not Jewish, there were no doubts in the minds of his classmates. In his memoir of life at Yale, poet Lawrence Bacon, an O-Niner, would begin a description of Moses with the words, "I saw a most attractive Jew." It wasn't only religion that made Moses an outsider during his first years at college. Not yet 17 years old, when he sat in Dwight Hall listening to President Arthur Twining Hadley's opening address, he was 2 years younger than most of his classmates. Men from the same prep school generally roomed together as freshmen, but while the 5 other men in 1909 from Mohegan Lake were fond of Bob, they kind of regarded him, in the words of a classmate, as a young boy, and they didn't invite him to room with them. In his freshman year, he boarded alone in a doctor's house near the campus. If he participated in any extracurricular activities or linked his arms with classmates to dance down Chapel Street and cheer Ted Coy for his 3 touchdowns against Princeton, or if he came rushing out of his room at the cry of riot to help freshmen overturn trolley cars and pelt policemen with water bombs, nobody noticed him. Boys selected their sophomore roommates from the friends they had made at Yale. In his sophomore year, Bob Moses again roomed alone, this time in a dormitory. Lonely, he frequently hung around the suite in another dormitory in which the Mohegan Lake alumni lived. Classmates remember him in his first 2 years as diffident, quiet, and shy. One of the wealthy prep school graduates who roomed in the big, friendly suites in Vanderbilt, most prestigious of the dormitories, would recall him as almost a recluse. At night, when the other students on his floor began to roughhouse, Moses would quietly close his door. Alone in his room, he would write poems, dreamy-eyed romances and imitations of Walter Pater and Swinburne. And he would read. When he found a subject that interested him, he would clear the library shelves of books on the subject, lug them back to his room, stack them on his desk, and read through the stack until it was finished. Ironically, it was the reading and writing he did behind the door closed against his classmates' shouts that first made them take an interest in him. There was on the campuses of that era a respect for scholarliness and brilliance, and Bob Moses' classmates slowly began to realize the extent to which he possessed these qualities. One of the members of the Mohegan Lake suite says, "I liked Bob from the first, but in the beginning it was a sort of paternal feeling. When he'd come around to the room, he'd seem so young and lost. But then I began to be attracted to him for his mind. I loved Latin. I got very high marks in it. But I knew just enough Latin to know that Bob was on a level way above mine. He really knew Latin. I started talking to him, and I became aware of a quality of mind that was exceptional. He was brilliant. I liked talking to him, and I became friendly with him. And that was what happened between Moses and a lot of people. By the end of sophomore year or the beginning of junior year, people were beginning to talk about him. He became admired for his scholarship, and all of a sudden, we noticed he was coming around to our suite less and less. He had gotten friends of his own." Moses began to submit his poetry for publication, not to the famous Yale Literary Magazine, where Leonard Bacon and cadaverous, freckle-faced, red-haired Sinclair Lewis were among the classmates competing for places on the board, but to a newer, less prestigious publication, the Yale Courant. Encouraged by the acceptance of a poem for the December 1907 issue, he contributed more poems and several short stories, and when, in March 1908, the new Courant editorial board was selected, he was on it. He also joined the Yale swimming team. Swimming occupied approximately the same position in relation to other sports at Yale as the Courant did to the Lit. Intercollegiate competition in the sport had begun only a few years before, and few colleges had swimming teams. A highlight of meets was still an event called the Plunge for Distance, in which the winner was the competitor who, after diving into the pool, could travel the farthest without moving his arms or legs. At Yale, the team practiced, in an ancient, dank, low-ceilinged, too-short pool, only 3 times a week. The Yale Daily News reported the results of the meets, when it reported them at all, at the very end of the list of sports results. Even after fencing and wrestling, and thanks to the influence of Walter Camp, who felt that the famous Yale Y should be worn only by football, hockey, and baseball players, he wasn't too sure about hockey and baseball. Swimmers were eligible only for a YSA, an insignia standing for Yale Swimming Association. Moses joined the swimming team as a sophomore. If he ever won a race, the victory was not reported in the news. But he was known as a hard worker in practice and a fierce competitor in meets, and he could be counted upon for second or third place points in either the 50-yard or the 100-yard crawl. As a junior, Moses was elected manager, an honor which entitled him to arrange meets and buy the team's train tickets. Swimming and the Courant enabled Bob Moses to broaden his acquaintance at Yale, and the classmates who got to know him began to see something special in the tall, slim Jew from New York, very handsome in the required high, rounded collar, who had the huge, emotional eyes and earnest, passionate manner of the idealist, the poet, the lover, in the phrase they learned in a popular course on Walter Pater, of the good, the true, and the beautiful. The eyes and the manner, these classmates learned, were not misleading. Not only was Bob Moses a poet, but his poems were poems like the dreamy-eyed Song of the Arctic Nereid, a hymn to the nymphs of the sea, or fragments from the French. Fair night, afar the day has fled. Fair night, a torch divine o'erhead. God's goodness flames eternal and abides, our erring footsteps keeps and watching guides. Fair night, tomorrow, but is the morrow sure tomorrow? The lashes slumber lure. Ah, shall we greet the dawning day? Perchance in vain we longing say, tomorrow. And the idealism was deep. Not only had Bob Moses read most of Pater, he believed in what he had read. He loved learning genuinely, and for its own sake. If he was competitive in swimming, he wasn't in classroom work. He wasn't uninterested in Marx, but he wasn't especially concerned about them either. He spent night after night behind a closed door, reading, but his friends began to realize that the reading was not for grades. Sometimes they would look at the stack of books on his desk, and not one of them had anything to do with the courses he was taking. They were there because they interested him. And their subjects covered a wide spectrum of knowledge. If Moses seemed particularly fascinated by literature and history, he was also reading everything he could find on the history of art. One of his friends was taking German. He came across a phrase one day that seemed to fit Bob Moses. Durch die Geist. Moses did indeed, the friend said, have a thirsty mind. After his sophomore year, one of his new friends went with Moses to Europe. Many college men spent their summers in Europe in the halcyon days before the Great War, but most of them spent their 8 weeks abroad in the lobbies of the fashionable hotels of Paris, Rome, and Geneva, striking up conversations, under the indulgent eyes of chaperones, with young ladies making their grand tours. Moses, the friend reported on their return to Yale, bounded out of bed early in the morning to be at museums when they opened, and he stayed in the museums all day. In Venice, which became his favorite European city, he spent hours in front of the famous Giotto frescoes and Michelangelo statues, and more hours searching out frescoes and statues that his companion had never heard of, but about which Moses, in those long nights behind the closed door, had learned every detail. Moses' greatest enthusiasm was reserved for a more famous work of art, the Mona Lisa. He seemed riveted to the floor of the Louvre in front of the painting. When he got back to Yale in the fall, he wrote poems about it, including one, apparently done in the style of Swinburne's Dolores, that called her Our Lady Divine. In literature, his greatest enthusiasm was for Samuel Johnson. Chauncey Brewster Tinker, a young professor whose empathy for Johnson's era was reflected in an almost 18th-century courtesy and insistence on form, but whose austerity was burned away on the lecture platform by what one colleague called the white fire of the poet, made his Johnson and His Circle course a journey in a beautiful and exciting country. Wandering off on his own, Bob Moses explored that country's byways. The assigned reading included excerpts from Boswell's biography of Johnson. Moses read the book complete, became interested in biography, and proceeded to read stacks of biographies, as well as books on the nature of that genre. His friends began to see that Moses' idealism was not confined to the printed page. If the more perceptive members of his class realized that democracy of talent was a false description of life at Yale, Moses had specific ideas on how to make the slogan a reality. The suggestion that class officers be chosen on merit rather than on the basis of fraternity membership was not the only remedy for Yale's social ossification which Moses proposed, both in late evening bull sessions and in the current. He was also, for instance, insistent that some sort of social recognition should be given for scholastic achievement. And, in at least one instance, he proved his willingness to fight for his ideals. Moses not only enjoyed swimming himself, he was convinced that the sport should receive more emphasis at Yale because, as a classmate put it, he regarded it as something in which every undergraduate could take pleasure, as contrasted with the gladiatorial sports like football and baseball. He had the same feeling about other minor sports, such as tennis, track, golf, gymnastics, fencing, shooting, and wrestling, all of which had, like swimming, been only recently incorporated into the intercollegiate athletic scene. His enthusiasm about them reached such a peak, in fact, that his friends jokingly began to call him the minor sport. Every attempt to upgrade such sports at Yale had run head-on into the frenzy over football. It was the era when gridiron heroes like Ted Coy and Tad Jones were the campus gods, when the winner of the Big Three title was national champion, when every victory was celebrated with bonfires and torchlight parades down Chapel Street, and into the personal opposition of Camp, who, in addition to being first among the Eli football pantheon, had the more practical advantage of being treasurer of the athletic union. With the Yale Bowl that was his dream drawing ever closer to reality, Camp had been squirreling away the annual surplus of the union with such enthusiasm that it had already reached $120,000, and he was not about to turn any of it over to the sports he derided. Bearding Camp in his suite at the New Haven House, Moses suggested a distribution of some of the football surplus among the minor sports. Camp flatly refused to give him a nickel. Another undergraduate might have left quietly. Recalling the scene, Moses was to say, "What you have to understand is what a colossal influence he had. He dominated all of athletics there. His word was absolutely law." But this undergraduate, before leaving, told Camp that someday the minor sports would be just as important on the intercollegiate scene as baseball and hockey. And although Camp treated the prediction as kind of a joke, he was soon to stop laughing, for Moses refused to let the matter drop. In editorials in The Current and the Yale Daily News, Moses attacked with a directness unusual in college publications of the day, pointing out that almost as many men participated in minor as in major sports. Moses accused Yale's football managers, a euphemism understood perfectly by the Yale community, of being unjust to one half of Yale athletics. Camp let it be known that he was personally offended. The editorials continued. Dean Baldy Wright called Moses to his office for a friendly but pointed discussion. The editorials continued. And when Moses came up with a plan to create a minor sports association that would hold a single fundraising drive, raise $3,500, and, through an executive committee composed of the sports managers, distribute it among the various teams according to their needs, the dean hastily gave the association permission to appeal to alumni for contributions, and also brought back word of a concession from Camp that was small but significant, coming from a man who had previously run Yale athletics without making any concessions at all. If the association raised $3,200, Camp's athletic union would contribute the other $300. Persuading the minor sports to combine into one association, which meant turning over their finances to an outside body, proved almost as difficult as persuading Camp. Hockey and basketball, which were classed among these sports but were popular enough among students so that their managers could generally raise money by a door-to-door appeal on campus, were particularly reluctant. Yet because hockey and basketball were the only two of the minor sports in which there was much interest, their participation was essential. Moses argued that even for hockey and basketball, the existence of a formal association would make it much easier to obtain money from alumni and students who had treated as a joke the many separate appeals from the different minor sports. And the idealist also argued on higher grounds. In one editorial, he wrote, "As far as basketball and hockey are concerned per se, they have nothing to gain. But there must be a sacrifice on the part of the basketball and hockey teams for the sake of common good." Hockey and basketball agreed to join. The other sports followed. On June 11, 1908, Moses was able to announce the formation of the Yale University Minor Sports Association. With Moses organizing its fund drives, the association proved to be more vigorous than Camp had expected. When he realized the extent of its fundraising efforts among alumni, traditional fountainhead of football funds, Moses was called in by Dean Wright and advised to be calm and dignified. Any undue pressure on alumni, he was warned, would result in the withdrawal of the $300 offer. Moses promptly made the threat public in the Current and announced that the fundraising would continue. Moses' friends, and men on campus who had previously hardly noticed him, were impressed by his courage. 60 years after he graduated, one member of the swimming team could recall that the report was that he and Camp had quite a go at it. We thought it was quite a thing. Moses' idealism began to be talked about widely in the class, and it was because of this that Ed Richards was all the more surprised when, on a day in January 1909, he climbed out of the pool after doing his laps and heard what Moses was suggesting about Og Reed. After I had accepted his resignation, Richards recalls, he began to put pressure on me to take him back on the team and let him go ahead with his approach to Reed. He managed to work up an amazing amount of pressure. He really was very clever about it. He got the managers of the other minor sports to send a delegation to me to talk me out of it. I told them, no, it's not an honest way to treat Og Reed. He's always treated us very nicely. Then Bob went to the man who was the heart and soul of swimming at Yale, Maxie Swartz. Maxie was really just the janitor at the pool, but he was a good old guy. He took a lot of interest in the swimmers, and he was always around the team. Bob got Maxie to ask me to take him back. He had Maxie tell me, oh, Reed has plenty of money. He'll never miss a little of it. But I talked it over with a few other guys on the team, and they said I was right, and I refused Maxie, too. Although Richard's firmness terminated Moses' connection with Yale athletics, his activity in more esoteric areas of campus life continued. His interest in art and poetry had made him a member of 1909's little clique of intellectuals and aesthetes, and, to some extent, he was becoming its leader. He was active on the Current. He may not have been invited to join any of the more important clubs at Yale, but he became president of the one he did join, the Kit Kat Club, a new organization which was named after the group of convivial literary spirits who had surrounded Samuel Johnson and which included Yale men who have shown literary ability and interest in literary subjects. During his senior year, he and a classmate published Yale Verse, an anthology of the best undergraduate poetry of the previous 10 years. Moses' academic work continued to be outstanding. A half century after he graduated, a professor said, "I well remember Robert Moses in my classes. He was alert, enthusiastic, very active, always doing A work. He was a model student. It was the energy of the man and his very great intelligence that I remember most clearly." Seniors were awarded premiums, small cash awards established by alumni for outstanding work. Moses won a handful for math and English and Latin, in English composition for an essay on the Mona Lisa, besides making Phi Beta Kappa. Though Moses had lived alone during his first 2 years at Yale, in his last two he had roommates. As a senior, Raymond P. McNulty and Elias 5A Johnson. "I didn't come to him," Johnson recalls. "He approached me and asked me to room with him. Of course I was glad to. We had been friendly before, but I think the fact that he approached me is an indication of a tendency I noticed in Bob. He selected his friends." The friends Bob Moses selected were of a specific type: cultured, artistic, interested in the things he was interested in, many of them members of the tight little circle that included members of Kit Kat and the Current. They included Malcolm T. Dougherty, who had already displayed the talent that was to make him a prominent painter of marine life, class poets like Bacon, Carl Thurston, and Ed Proctor, and Current and Lit contributors like James McConaughey, later governor of Connecticut, and Harold Phelps Stokes, later chief editorial writer of the New York Herald Tribune. Johnson, a very poor boy from Chicago attending Yale on a scholarship, was perhaps Moses' closest friend. He had already earned a reputation as the class brain, and if Moses loved to read, 5A loved to study. Night after night, the two young men would retire immediately after supper to their living room in Whitehall and stay at their desks until midnight or 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, when they'd take long walks, which usually ended in a little all-night luncheonette, which served the turn-of-the-century equivalent of the late-evening hamburger, a heaping bowl of cornflakes and milk. In honor of Johnson's slimness, he carried 120 pounds on a 5-foot-7-inch frame, Moses gave him a new nickname, Slat. On weekends, he often took Slat home to the apartment Bella and Emmanuel had rented in 1906 in a large apartment house at the corner of Central Park West and 70th Street, coming down to New York by train and across town from the station by horse-drawn streetcars. To while away time on the trips, the boys would play an early version of 20 Questions, Ask Me Another. But Johnson, despite his 5 A's, confessed himself hopelessly outclassed. Bob had the damnedest questions on art and poetry and whatnot through the ages, he would recall. His reading was fantastic. His circle of friends liked and admired Bob Moses. He was always glad to see you, one says. He really liked you, and you liked him. He might love to read, but he was certainly no greasy grind. He enjoyed jokes, telling them and hearing them, and he had a quick, infectious laugh. Tall and strong, he enjoyed running and mountain climbing, once leading several friends to the top of Whiteface Mountain in the Adirondacks. He and Johnson might spend most evenings studying, but on some evenings they would walk along Chapel Street, where the townies, New Haven girls who were not averse to meeting Yale boys, paraded, and Moses was notably successful at striking up conversations, much to the discomfort of the painfully shy Slat. I remember that one night when we were reading, Bob suddenly jumped up and said, "Come on, let's take a walk," Slat recalls. We went down Chapel Street, and there were a couple of girls ahead of us, and he made some kind of remark, and they started laughing. I got afraid and went back to the room, but he walked off with them. What his friends admired most was his idealism. Sometimes it took rather odd forms. One night, he and the scrawny Johnson had an argument that escalated into a short but violent fight, and Moses showed no hesitation in knocking sprawling a man so much smaller than he. But once Johnson was down, Moses helped him up and, shaking his hand, congratulated him on his courage in fighting someone bigger and stronger. In discussions about campus life, however, Moses was more consistent. His appeals for true democracy at Yale continued. The argument about which fraternity's nominee should be given the class office was one example. Johnson was trying to convince a group of classmates of the right of his fraternity to the job when Moses suddenly jumped up and, in Johnson's recollection, bawled the living daylights out of me. He was saying things like, "What does the fraternity have to do with it? It should be on the basis of ability." But it wasn't so much what he said as the way he said it. You could see he was speaking from the heart. You could see the honesty coming through in what he was saying. And all of a sudden I was ashamed. Of course, I saw he was right. Why should money or influence or who a guy's friends were matter? When bull session discussions turned to careers after college, Moses said he was going to go into public service. He didn't have any specific plans, and even talked occasionally of teaching government. But more and more, his thinking seemed to his friends to be turning to a more active role. He wanted, he told them, to help the underprivileged, the lower classes, the people ground down by forces beyond their control. These phrases were not unusual ones among college seniors. But Moses' friends were impressed by the intensity, the evident deep belief with which he spoke them. As Moses' acquaintance expanded, moreover, so did the admiration. When, during his senior year, his class held elections for the 7-member senior council, the winners were 6 fraternity men and Bob Moses, who, with 59 votes, came in 3rd. Other barriers could not be breached, of course. As graduation neared, 1909 elected its socially prestigious class day committees. Moses was elected to neither the class supper committee, the senior prom committee, the cap and gown committee, nor to any of the 16 other committees selected. By the time the class graduated, 45 men were in the senior societies, 100 in the junior fraternities, 51 in the sophomore societies, and Moses was not one of them. He never lived in Vanderbilt Hall, and to many of the men who did live in Vanderbilt and who did participate in the secret ceremonies of Skull and Bones or Wolf's Head, the honors that Robert Moses did achieve were unimportant. "Frankly," says one of them in accents ancestral, "I couldn't tell you what the Kit Kat Club was, or the Senior Council." When 1909 voted for its outstanding members, Moses received only a few scattered votes as brightest, most scholarly, and done most for Yale. In the official class history, which listed the rosters of clubs and committees and their outstanding members, his name hardly appeared at all. But what was perhaps significant about Bob Moses and the class history was not that his name appeared in it infrequently, but that it appeared in it at all. His achievements at Yale might be dim beside those of the prep school Episcopalian leaders of the secret societies, but they were bright indeed for a Jew. If in his first 2 years at Yale, Bob Moses had been a lonely nobody, in his last 2 years, he had become considerably more than that. And the way in which he had become more was, in the light of his later career, even more significant. He became a campus figure, partly, of course, because of the brilliance and idealism that were part of his inheritance. He displayed also, in his refusal to knuckle under to Walter Camp, his inherited stubbornness, and a considerable amount of real moral courage. But in the light of his later career, what is most interesting is that when he realized that, because of the handicap of his religion, his brilliance and idealism would not take him to the top in the world of Yale, he made, within Yale, a world of his own, and a world, moreover, in which, in collegiate terms, he had power and influence. He never went out for the lit, but he made himself an important member of the staff of a less prestigious publication. He never went out for a major sport, but he was active in a minor one. He was never invited to join one of the better clubs, but he was president of the lesser club he did join. And if he was not included in the more select social circles of the class, he created a circle of his own, a small coterie of persons with like interests, a coterie within which he was the acknowledged leader. The men in the coterie admired Bob Moses. The men he chose to be his friends were happy to be chosen. Alongside the massive cathedrals of Yale's traditions, buttressed by prejudice and pride, Bob Moses had erected his own small but sturdy structure. In our little world, Bacon was to say, he made himself a position of power. In the light of Moses' later career, that was the key point. Chapter 3. Home Away from Home. As a senior at Yale, Moses had decided to go on to Oxford. He had wanted to go as a Rhodes Scholar, but every third year the prestigious scholarships were not awarded, and 1909 was a third year. Unwilling to wait until 1910, and with no financial need to, he paid his own way. Asked in later years why he had chosen Oxford for his postgraduate work, Moses would shrug and say there had been no special reason. But his choice turned out to be an apt one. He was to find in Oxford a spiritual home. The marriage of Bernard Cohen and Rosalie Silverman had been a marriage of brilliant mind with brilliant mind, and of idealism, crystallized in a desire to improve the lives of the lower classes with an overweening arrogance. The strain of brilliance, idealism, and arrogance had surfaced in a daughter, Lady Bountiful, and had been passed on through her, undiluted, strong but somewhat formless, to her son Robert. Oxford, using the brilliance as catalyst, was to refine the other two ingredients in the strain. 2 years among her spires and statue-crowned columns, her quadrangles and cloisters, her towers that had whispered to Matthew Arnold the last enchantments of the Middle Ages, would boil the fattiness out of the idealism, rendering out of a vague desire to help people not only a clear, definable concept of public service, but also a specific means of performing that service. 2 years among her richly paneled halls, her ancestral tankards and inlaid croziers, among begowned processions led by beadles carrying silver staves, and among gardens tended by 1,000 gardeners, would distill the arrogance, potent though it already was, and make it still more potent by adding to its essence a philosophical base, the British belief, firm indeed in the early 20th century and epitomized in the trappings and teachings of Oxford, in the duties and the rights of those born to wealth and privilege. Oxford in 1909 was the castle keep of British conservatism. The key to its ancient gates was wealth. In the year Robert Moses entered Oxford's Wadham College, the university was largely closed to the student whose family was not rich. Conservatism characterized the attitude of its students, including the 90 Americans among them. When, 3 months after Moses' arrival, an American club was organized, its first meeting featured 2 speakers who said, respectively, "We are as much interested as anyone in preserving Oxford as a home of English conservatism and tradition," and "We should carry into the bustle and stir of the new world the atmosphere of the old." As strong as Oxford's conservatism was its emphasis on public service. Its tone in 1909 had been set for the preceding 3 centuries by rich young men who were sent to the university as a preliminary to public life, and who, from positions in Parliament or the civil service or the learned professions, actually did, after graduation, govern Britain and its vast territories overseas. But the leavening of devotion to public service with an unabashed insistence on the rights and privileges of aristocracy could not help but make that devotion somewhat patronizing, infusing it with a strong air of condescension and noblesse oblige in its most obnoxious form. It was a refined, more subtle, but also more deeply rooted version of the attitude of the German Jews of New York toward the Russian and Polish latecomers, of Bella toward the children whose parents didn't even know how to bring them up so they would be able properly to clean the cabins Madison House had been kind enough to build for them. Bella's son was very happy at Oxford. His most frequent companion was Mal Doherty, his friend from Yale, who was also studying at Wadham. "Bob had a very good time at Oxford," Doherty recalls. "He liked it very much. It was such a relief after Yale. Yale had that pseudo-democracy, but it was not democratic at all. It was snooty, with all that social tradition. When we got to Oxford, we found all this changed. It was understood by everyone there that by the very fact that you belonged to Oxford, you were the select and the elect. You didn't have to compete for prestige or honors to become one of the elite. Because you were there, you were the elite." Moses' understanding of this fact, and his acceptance of it, shone through an article he sent to the Yale Alumni Weekly. "There is a moribund institution for workingmen's sons somewhere in Oxford," he sneered. "I have never yet met an undergraduate who knew its exact location, nor have I met anyone who did not become incoherent with rage when it was defended." Moses liked the gentleman's life that Oxford offered. Breakfast, lunch, and tea were served in the students' rooms, and they were encouraged to entertain friends, of whom Moses had plenty. Says one classmate, "Bob was almost universally loved." The first American in history to be elected captain of the dark blue water polo team, he was also swimming captain, although, as at Yale, if he ever won a race, the victory went unrecorded. Taking up debating, he became the first American ever to be elected president of the august Oxford Union, that heartiest of debating clubs. Oxford's exemption of students from all marks and tests except for a single, all-inclusive examination given after 2 years appealed to the student who even at Yale had refused to be bound by the confines of his courses. The Oxford education confers on the average undergraduate independence of mind, he wrote in the Alumni Weekly. Vacations were an especially happy time. Moses and Doherty spent their vacs on walking tours of England or traveling abroad, often with Moses' roommate, John Gilbert Higgins, a Rhodes Scholar from Newfoundland, who sported a long knitted scarf and a thick Irish brogue. In Switzerland, the youths tried out a sport that was just beginning to attract the attention of American tourists, skiing. In Italy, Moses saw again the frescoes and statues he had loved as an undergraduate and spent hours being gondolaed around Venice, a city with which he had fallen in love. Every summer, his family would sail to Europe and take a large suite of rooms in a hotel overlooking the Lake of Lucerne. There, Moses and Darty played tennis, swam, and climbed mountains. In 1911, a Rhodes scholar named El Alail, the son of an Egyptian bey, invited Moses and Darty to visit Egypt. Crossing the Mediterranean on a leaky, shuddering tub named the Equator, the youths found themselves in the company of hundreds of Levantine natives and a troop of women Darty describes as international tarts sailing for the winter season in Cairo and Alexandria. On the first night out of Marseille, the Equator's captain selected one, disappeared with her into his cabin, and remained there for the rest of the four-day voyage. The same procedure was followed by every other officer except an aged quartermaster. The engines broke down, along with the latrines. But when the ship, and its attendant aroma, arrived at Alexandria, El Alail ensconced Moses and Darty in luxury. The three youths spent the days swimming on a magnificent beach at the mouth of the easternmost branch of the Nile, and evenings chatting over dinner with the highest British colonial and native Egyptian officials, including the Khedive of Egypt. The Khedive must have been impressed with Moses. He asked him to be his secretary. The mark of Oxford's influence would be plain on Robert Moses for the rest of his life. Oxonians habitually wore bags, old flannel trousers so long unpressed that they were completely shapeless, and sweaters or heavy tweed jackets. The academic gowns required for lectures were often worn along with bedroom slippers. Moses, who had always been exceptionally neat in dress before Oxford, would return to New York affecting a carelessness about attire that at times went to extremes. Insisting he needed only one suit, he would wear it until it was shiny. He had only one pair of shoes, which he never shined. Returning home on a rainy day, he would sit in front of the fire in the Moses' luxurious living room, holding his feet close to the flames, making a point of telling friends that he couldn't go out again until his shoes had dried because he didn't have another pair. He obtained new underwear and socks only when his mother bought them for him. After his marriage, his wife would take over this chore, and, since he refused to go to clothing stores at all, would select suits herself, have them brought to their apartment, and arrange for a tailor to come and fit them there. And if Moses was to return from Oxford with a somewhat studied indifference toward clothes, he was to display the same attitude toward money, an attitude which some friends felt, from remarks that Moses made, was an attempt to imitate the scions of British nobility he met at Oxford, who never thought of money because they had no need to. His family first saw this attitude on board the luxury liner Potsdamer in the harbor at Southampton, where they had just picked up Robert before going on to Lucerne. When Emmanuel began to tell his son about money that had been deposited for his Oxford expenses in a London bank account, Robert, who previously had had a normal college boy's interest in his allowance, said loftily, "I don't want to talk about things like that." The affectation that may have underlain this attitude is suggested by another trait that became apparent at Oxford, a seeming compulsion to pick up checks, to be the host at every gathering. Darty, who was not in need of subsidy, recalls, "If you went anywhere with Bob, to lunch or dinner or to have a drink, he'd grab the check and just insist on paying it. It got so people felt a little annoyed, but if you grabbed one first, you'd have to have sort of a squabble with him about it." Oxford was also influencing the young man on more significant levels. In long letters to his parents, he said that he had definitely decided to dedicate his life to public service. On his return to the United States, he said, he would make a career in government. He even had his field picked out. He intended to become an expert on the renowned British Civil Service, so that he could inculcate its principles in America. Government pay might not be high, he said, but he didn't care about money. Bella Moses read the letters to relatives with approval. And while Oxford was refining and strengthening Moses' idealism, it was having the same effect on his arrogance, which increasingly took the form of galloping Anglophilia. Moses' admiration for things Oxonian broadened into an admiration, strikingly deep, for all things British. Coupled with this feeling was one almost of scorn for things American. Writing to the Yale Alumni Weekly in praise of the single examination Oxford system of education, he went beyond the praise to say, "I hesitate to imagine the introduction of such a scheme in the United States, where intellectual independence is safeguarded by daily recitations." There was another overtone, too. Under the influence of Oxford's conservative insistence on the rightness of the British system's provisions for keeping the reins of government in the hands of a highly educated upper class, Moses came more and more to admire that system. Such admiration, of course, postulated as a concomitant, an amiable contempt for the capability for government found in members of the lower classes, which in this context included everyone not a member of the British nobility. And from this attitude, it was a logical step to reserve supreme contempt for those whom the British aristocracy considered most incapable of self-rule, the people of the nations British troops had conquered, which meant, in general, people of color, brown, yellow, or black. Moses took this step. With agitation for increased self-government rising in Great Britain's colonies, Oxford in 1911 sponsored a World Congress on Race Problems to examine the question, along with the broader question of general discrimination by Great Britain against colored people. Delegations were sent by the colonies and by liberal organizations from many European countries. American students selected Moses to represent their country because of his reputation as a debater. Previous speakers had pleaded for equality, for fraternity, for immediate brotherhood. Moses' point of view was somewhat different. Immediate brotherhood, he said flatly, was not practical. The subject peoples of the British Empire were simply not ready for self-government yet. Furthermore, he didn't see any time in the near future when they would be. As the audience realized what they were hearing, a certain restiveness began to develop. When Moses started explaining, quite clearly, why he didn't think the subject peoples would be ready for self-government for a long time, several subject people rose and charged at him. One step ahead of them was roommate Higgins. He grabbed Moses, shoved him through a door at the back of the speaker's platform, and hustled him out of the building. The climax of Moses' academic career was the thesis he submitted for a PhD degree, The Civil Service of Great Britain. The thesis contained no torch divine or head. The floridness of Moses' Yale poetry and prose style had turned hard, cogent, and marvelously lucid at Oxford. Short, hard sentences must have carried his professors through the intricacies of parliamentary infighting and regulation rewriting with refreshing ease. He displayed not only a complete familiarity with a bewildering array of bureaucratic technicalities, but a gift for the felicitous phrase. Describing Carlyle's appeal to Parliament to muck out the Aegean stables of bureaucracy, Moses wrote that Carlyle appealed with excremental eloquence. Macaulay's speech on the need for promotion by merit was, he said, the most masterly vindication of the principles of competition ever left unanswered. Not only Moses' prose style, but what was behind the style had hardened too. The all-too-conscious revelation in the thesis's pages of what the British civil service symbolized to Robert Moses demonstrated that 2 years of Oxford had solidified the cast of mind formed in the mold of heredity and upbringing. The youth who had been raised in an atmosphere pervaded by a mixture of idealism and arrogance had found the rationale for such noblesse oblige in the British theory of the rights and duties of the upper classes. The thesis with which he laid the capstone of his education focused down on the British civil service as the embodiment of this attitude, the practical result of this theory. And he saw the result as glorious. The thesis reveals its author as a man convinced that public service is a noble calling and one that must be based on the highest ideals. Moses did not believe that the perfection of the British civil service system was an end in itself. Rather, he saw it as an instrument, an indispensable one, for the implementation of great social reforms. Progressive nations, he wrote, had begun creating new departments of government to free mankind from the traditional horrors of old age, disease, and unemployment. These new departments, he said, must have leaders and a personnel with outstanding qualifications if they are to fulfill their noble purpose. His idealism is further documented by his admiration, an admiration that approached idolatry, for the uncompromising reformers, Trevelyan, Northcote, the genius Macaulay, who had fought to make the civil service system equal to the new demands, and by the vehemence, the sincere, deep passion of the phrases with which he described the patronage system that had been the reformers' chief obstacle. Quoting descriptions of the incompetence whom patronage foisted upon the service, he cited a report which concluded, "Patronage is the worst form of bribery," and concurred with feeling. "The incessant demands of office-seekers and the contemptible meanness and petty irritations attendant on a distribution of favors are," he said, "intolerable." Merit, open competition, Moses said again and again, should be the sole basis of appointment and promotion in public life. Mingled with the idealism, of course, was the arrogance. It was subordinate to the idealism. If the idealism was displayed in Moses' convictions about what should be done, the arrogance emerged only in his convictions as to who was best suited to do it. But it was every bit as pure and uncompromising. The Civil Service of Great Britain reveals its author as the possessor of a depth of class feeling and conservatism more appropriate to a retired colonel of the guards than a young progressive from New York City. Open competition may be what the young author said he wanted, but the openness was to certain individuals only. Merit may be the determinant he said he desired, but it was not merit based on a man's handling of his job. The competition Moses wanted was a competition open only to a highly educated upper class. The merit he was talking about was merit not in public service, but in the education given exclusively to members of that class. What Moses admired in the British civil service was that it had two separate and distinct classes, a very small administrative and policy-making upper division reserved for university men, and a much larger lower division, consisting of clerks of ordinary education selected through examinations on the high school level, who do the lower and more mechanical work. The class differentiation that Moses admired was a rigid one. Carefully placed technical hurdles made it difficult, almost impossible, for a young man, even one of dedication, industry, ambition, and talent, to rise out of the lower division. Brilliant, Moses called this setup. Far-sighted. It attracts into public service precisely the men most needed there, the most intelligent and capable young men in universities, he said, and it keeps them in government by reserving for them posts from which they can exert real influence and authority. With criticisms of the system, Moses had little patience. The question of admitting natives to the Indian service comes up now and again, but it can hardly be said to be acute, he said. Few care to make the trip to England. The suggestion that examinations be held also in India has been voted down thus far, he noted, and this is fortunate. There are as many places open to them now as they are reasonably capable of filling. Was there perhaps a question as to the democracy of such a system? Moses' answer was that a civil service with no class differentiation is one of mediocrity, and such democracy is false democracy. What about the young man who educates himself, who goes to night school, perhaps, and earns a college degree while he is in the lower division of the civil service? Might not he be considered fit for promotion? Well, Moses said, My conclusions on this difficult question of democracy versus education in the civil service are these. In a sense, it is a cruel thing to set up class distinctions, even if they only be intellectual. But where does our sympathy lead us? Can the state repair the defects of heredity or of early education? Can it endow the average individual with the intelligence, acuteness, and cultivation which economic exigencies have denied him? There should be no social bar to promotion from the lowest to the highest place, but let us not fool ourselves. When we have made every possible provision for the encouragement of early promise, when we have prepared every child as far as possible for its suitable vocation, the subordinate employees of the government who are fit to rise above the ranks will be few and far between. As for recent complaints of the lower-class civil servants about wage scales and working conditions, Moses said there was no need to worry about those subjects. The writer believes, in spite of Mr. Walling and his socialistic brethren, that the civil servant may safely depend upon the public parliamentary recognition of the justice of his cause, upon the fairness of the treasury or a minister, and upon royal commissions to get real grievances redressed and reasonable demands granted. What was of more concern to the writer, in fact, was that the lower-class workers might not understand this and might continue agitating, might, in fact, even form unions. Hopefully, a sense of loyalty would stop the workers short of such an act of open rebellion, but if this should not be the case, Moses said, in the last analysis, there must be the remorseless exercise of the executive power of suppression and dismissal to solve this question. The last chapter of Moses' thesis is a plea to his own country to adopt the British system for its own civil service. The chapter is pervaded by contempt for the standards of government service in the United States, where spoilsmen and job-hungry politicians lurk everywhere, and we have been so busy fighting for a full realization of the competitive principle that the great problems of division, of intellectual qualifications, and attracting the best men into our government departments have been quite neglected, so that government is staffed by a very miscellaneous and often ill-educated division of clerks. Patronage must be eliminated, and an upper division created immediately, he said. To follow Moses' suggestions, the United States would have had to close almost completely the higher ranks of government service, not only to all men without a college degree, but to all men without a degree from an Ivy League college. In fact, by logical extension of Moses' philosophy, graduates of Columbia, Cornell, Brown, Dartmouth, and Penn would be allowed in those higher ranks only by sufferance. In his view, government in America should be ruled, as was football at the time, by men whose birth and breeding had allowed them to attend one of three colleges, Princeton, Harvard, or, of course, Yale. Moses said in his thesis that he feared that America's acceptance of this suggestion would be delayed by its exaggerated concern for equality. Most men are simply incapable of handling the demands of government service, Moses said, and the time has come for Americans to realize it. We must decide, the young author said, how much encouragement we may honestly offer to those who expect to rise from the ranks without the almost essential early education of the university man. Moses saw only one real hope for his country, the fact that a man who had met his highest standards, Woodrow Wilson of Princeton, had just been elected president. Wilson's writings, Moses felt, show not only a clear understanding of the defects of our civil service, but also a keen realization of the executive leadership necessary to remedy them. Moses had begun the thesis after graduation, with honors, from Oxford in June 1911. After a last summer in Lucerne, he spent the fall of 1911 doing research in London. Then he spent a term studying political science at the University of Berlin. Returning to New York in the summer of 1912, he moved back into his old room on Central Park West. It was the height of his one suit, one pair of shoes period, but Bella at least made sure that the suit was an expensive white tropical from Brooks Brothers, and began writing. He enrolled in Columbia University's School of Political Science, but took no courses formally, spending most of his time on the thesis, which he completed in the summer of 1913. As soon as he finished it, and even before he took the oral examinations for the Columbia PhD he was to receive, he entered public service by getting a job with the Training School for Public Service of the Bureau